Welcome to the Industrial IoT Spotlight, your number one spot for insight from industrial IoT thought leaders who are transforming businesses today, with your host, Eric Walenza.
Welcome back to the Industrial IoT Spotlight. I'm joined today by Clint Bundy, who is the managing director at Bundy Group. Bundy Group is an investment bank that focuses on the automation sector. Let's talk a bit more about the market and the market trends generally. Software is eating the world, as they say. In the controls and automation space, we're coming from, I work with a lot of German companies. One of my partners is German. So working with a lot of German hardware companies that are in an interesting spot where they might be profitable and looking fairly good to, this year, looking fairly good next year. But then if they look out 5 years, somewhat troubled about what the future might hold. I'm curious in your perspective, from an investment perspective, how you look at hardware versus software valuations and the potential for the solutions in the market. Obviously, we're going to need a lot of hardware in the future. Hardware's not going away. It's just kind of an open question of differentiation and profit margin, in different technology categories. How do you view this as an advisor to companies and investors?
Yeah, it is an interesting topic on the hardware versus software. My client that I was just mentioning to you, they do both, and they really effectively sell their product as a solution, like the hardware and software together. I'm a fan of hardware, and there are a lot of good hardware-driven controls companies out there. Who are doing very well and have a lot of growth upside. I will have to say that if I were to provide observations on what I see a lot of, especially growth equity and private equity groups talking about, they love software. Software is relatively low capital expenditure. You've got to invest in R&D to build and maintain software, but it's once you sort of get to the steady state, that's a pretty predictable stream of investment. A lot of investor groups out there just don't get hardware. They're very shy of investing in hardware firms. So that doesn't mean there aren't buyers and investors for hardware-driven controls firms. But if I were starting up a company today, an IoT or a controls company, if I sort of had to pick which direction I wanted to take, and where I'm going to put my investment dollars towards, I would absolutely focus primarily on software and then probably consider outsourcing the hardware to someone else so that my P&L effectively just reflected recurring revenue through a software-driven model, if that sort of makes sense.
And you mentioned that this current client that you're working with does both hardware and software. Have you seen many companies, let's say mid-cap companies that have been succeeding in selling hardware for 10, 20, 30 years? Have you seen many that are able to make the transition and become software companies?
Yes. It takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of talent. But yes, I'll actually give you another case study if that's helpful. Again, unfortunately, I can't provide the name, but I can give you the profile. This is a controls and cybersecurity firm that had started as a company building hardware and computer systems for the control space. And out of that, they developed software applications. Now it's to the point where the software side of the business is probably worth anywhere from 5 to 10 times more than the hardware side of the business. Back to our earlier conversation about valuing technology and software firms, especially how they're valued off of recurring revenue versus kind of this hardware side, which actually this firm has a mix of hardware and system integration, that can potentially be valued more off of EBITDA. But what they've done, which I think is a good case study for other firms who are either in hardware, considering to get into software, or already in both, is that my suggestion to those firms would be to consider operating the hardware division under a separate P&L statement from the software division, for the simple reason that if one day comes they elect to either sell or to do a capital raise, they could potentially sell or do a capital raise for the software division and do it separate from the hardware and get better value and economics because they split the company up into two sort of separate silos. And so if you've got a lower valuation for the hardware side, then it will not dilute the value of the software side. And that's what's probably going to happen here in our client engagement, where we're going to split off the two companies and do a separate sale for both divisions. Let me stop there. Tell me if I rambled and that doesn't make sense.
No, that's a great piece of advice. Makes a lot of sense. You know, I'm talking with a company, a German company, produces industrial hardware sensors, and they were facing a challenge where their customers were making procurement decisions higher up in the stack. So they were making them around the analytics layer. You know, what are we going to do with the data? That was the primary driver. And then once they had a concept of how we're going to manage the data, what we're going to do with it, they would then, you know, identify a vendor for that solution and ask that vendor, who do you recommend for the sensors? And so instead of having this direct touch point with their customers, they were becoming almost an outside sourced vendor, almost a subcontractor you could think of. And this was you know, a big challenge. So I think in that case, adding the, let's say, the software capability onto the business, and in this case, they actually did go and acquire a couple smaller software companies so that they could participate in those discussions higher up in the stack. And then that becomes, I think, a nice business with some synergy where the hardware side, you have a very established customer base where people have conversations with you, but you then have the software capability to have conversations across the stack. Question whether, you know, a lot of companies are able to make this transition. It's certainly possible. It's just a matter of having the capital, as you mentioned, in order to build the right business, and having the management team with some perspective into how they want to transform their business. Do you participate often in supporting companies? So supporting a multinational, for example, as in this case, somebody that is a bit larger and is looking for software capabilities or other capabilities to expand their portfolio in order to transform their capabilities? Or do you typically work on the seller side as a representative?
We will do both. We're very much an advisor to companies who are sort of coming to us and saying, you know, your example is a great one of, hey, we're a hardware-driven firm. We really need to extend our software capabilities. Do we do that by greenfielding it ourselves and hire the developers and come up with our own software solution? Or is it smarter for us to just go acquire a really highly strategic fit asset or company that we could tuck in underneath? And, you know, we very much spend a lot of time, whether it be on the seller side or the buyer side or the capital raise side, before we're actually ever engaged. It's very common for us to spend a lot of time talking through strategic options with potential clients and to walk them through the pros and cons of every strategy. So we absolutely are very, it's very common for us to have those conversations that you referenced in advance of whether or not we're engaged, of whether or not you should go acquire a software-driven firm. It's sometimes that's not the right strategy, depending on the dynamics of the situation, and especially the sophistication and the motivation of the buyer and the management team.
And let's talk a bit more about the IoT market in particular. So you're in the position of advising companies either on how to evaluate a potential target or on how to present themselves in their market as an attractive acquisition target. What do you see as the driving forces for adoption and the adoption barriers that are preventing the market from hitting that hockey stick growth, that growth curve?
I mean, the IoT market is just a fascinating space. And I hope that we'll be able to do another podcast in the next down the road, because I think any thoughts I give you today will be even further thoughts in our next podcast, because I think there's just so much interesting stuff going on and there's a really great vibe going on in the IoT space. But what I'm seeing today is driving it is, you know, customers want demand for information. A big driver of the controls market in general, which is why we're involved with it, is that, you know, these companies, whether it be an IoT firm or a control system integrator or what have you, they are they're on the front lines of helping their clients improve productivity. And anything that helps a client improve productivity and increase their margins is always going to be a highly valued asset to a client. So that's certainly a big driver, is clients wanting more information and more productivity improvements. And then the other, you know, interesting trend in IoT is that I just see it, it's attracting a lot of talented individuals because they recognize that this market is exploding. And where there's explosion, there's work opportunity, there's money to be made. There's the just the ability to collaborate with other smart people. And so, you know, and then that's creating a snowball effect of more talents leading to more performance and then vice versa. So this is just some of the key trends I see driving growth. On the resistance side, you know, and feel free to agree or disagree with me with anything I say here, Eric, because I know you're very well versed in the market. But I see, when I say client, I'm talking about the market's lack of understanding or fear of adoption of some of these technologies. They don't quite understand them yet because it is such an earlier-ish stage market. Certainly finding talent to develop and analyze and maintain these solutions is very, very challenging. I mean, that is the number one comment I hear from everybody, whether it's a technology firm, a system integration firm, an IoT firm, is when I ask them, what's your number one challenge? Without question, the first answer I get is finding the talent, period. And I think that's a huge issue. And certainly we need to, in our education system and universities, need to plan for that in the next 5 to 10 years. Cybersecurity, that's a major issue out there. With the good of all of these IoT devices and technologies goes the also massive risk that it opens up your systems to more cybersecurity, cyber violations. And there's, that's a whole separate topic we could do a whole separate podcast on. But those are just some of the resistance trends that I see.
I agree completely. We were over at the German Chamber this morning for a government delegation, and the topic was generally around innovation. You know, German companies innovating in China, there's on the one hand a lot of interest in Chinese innovation ecosystem and how they can participate, and on the other hand, some hesitancy around threats coming from China. Or willingness to invest, move R&D resources from Germany to China. But then the conversation got diverted to recruiting, and it turned basically into a discussion of how do you recruit good people when you're competing with Alibaba and Tencent, you know, here, and then in the US, Amazon and Google, and especially on the software side, on the AI, machine learning, you know, you're looking at markets where a talented individual can get paid $300,000-$400,000 a year, you know, with a half dozen years of experience, and it's really hard for a traditional company to justify these investments, right? You have to have a pretty long horizon on a kind of a big risk investment in order to, you know, put in the capital. But if you don't, then you're kind of out of that particular game, right? So I would agree completely that it's HR is not the sexiest topic, but it can be super important when you're planning to manage a technology shift. As companies are in this space.
Absolutely. Yeah, key management, key technical talent, key engineering talent, key salespeople. There's a vast shortage of it. I mean, I have a 5 and a 7 year old right now, and I would absolutely encourage them to look at this industry, to consider getting into this industry, because I think there's just massive opportunity there.
So your 5 and your 7 year old, when do you start taking in meetings with you?
I've enjoyed being in a family business. I've enjoyed working with my father. You know, if they have the right mindset and they enjoy learning and they enjoy seeing different situations and they enjoy meeting a lot of different people and sharing information, I think this is a good, my industry is a good industry to be in. But one comment I didn't make earlier about my industry is that specialization is more and more becoming key as investment banking. And so I've obviously taken that principle and applied it to the control space, because I think it's a great industry to be specialized in. No different than if you're an engineer or a salesperson, it's a great industry to be specialized in.
So you mentioned one other point on the adoption barriers, cybersecurity. What's your perspective on the market here? I think my vantage point, companies were underinvesting in cybersecurity for the past couple of years, just trying to get product out to market. There's been a lot of high profile hacks, and it looks like we might be turning a corner where the end users or the buyers are starting to put a premium on a secure solution, and also to an extent maybe just are better able to evaluate the differences in security of a solution. Do you see an uptick in this market?
I put cyber right in there with IoT, and they're kind of kissing cousins anyways, because where you have more IoT, you have more cyber risk. But, the growth in cyber, and I'll just give you a couple of stats here. You know, the industrial control system security market, that's going to grow, is estimated to grow from about $10 billion today, 2017, to about $14 billion by 2022. So that's a compound annual growth of about 6.5%. And that's probably conservative estimates. Another figure is companies. I read a statistic the other day that companies are spending on average around $11 million a year on cyber protection and systems. And I think we're only at the tip of the iceberg on cyber solutions, firewall, antivirus, anti-malware, DDoS, security information and event management. I don't even think we've hit the tip of the iceberg. And talk about a shortage of talent. I saw a quote from a professional in that space who he said, we basically right now probably need to create over the next few years about 1 million cyber warriors to help effectively protect our systems. And we're not doing that anywhere close to that pace. So in order to keep pace with that, we need to have more automation of cyber technology to keep pace with, you know, what's frankly a lot of scary players out there on the hacking and infiltration side.
Exactly. And this is a challenging market, because you put more talent out in the market and some percentage of the talent walks across to the other side of the table, and, you know, and then you're fighting against yourself. Yeah. In the looking at a healthcare situation where a company was trying to secure ad functionality to digitalize their hospital equipment, but do so in a secure way, because they'd been hit by, you know, a couple pretty significant fines because their data was stolen and sold. And it's just such a lucrative market for at least patient data, right? Maybe for industrial data, then we're getting into more company to company industrial espionage. But patient data, it's kind of just an open market. And if you're able to hack into it, you're going to find some ready buyers out there, legitimate companies that might be thinking that they're buying legitimate data. And that makes it really difficult to secure, because another company might have even a stronger profit motive to invest in hacking than you have to secure your data. Do you get involved in the healthcare sector, or is that kind of outside of your domain?
No, we're very involved in healthcare. A couple of clients we've worked with on the control side service the healthcare space and the pharma space. And then also one of our other verticals as an investment bank is healthcare. That's technology, services, and products. So the healthcare market has a lot of similarities to the controls market over the next 5 to 10 years in terms of growth and fragmentation and M&A and capital raise needs. So we're very bullish on healthcare too.
How do you evaluate that market? Because that's a market that seems to have an incredible amount of pent-up demand around digitalization. And then there's some pretty significant regulatory barriers, right, that kind of impact demand. As an advisor, how do you evaluate the ability for hospitals to address the security and the privacy concerns and really start investing in connecting these data sources that are kind of siloed at present among different systems and different entities?
It is a slower moving market, although I think it's starting to pick up the pace. I mean, you've got a lot more bureaucracy, you've got more regulation. In the U.S. at least, I mean, we've got a lot of uncertainty about Obamacare, and then how is that going to affect companies' profit margins? And so, but I do feel like, first on the cyber side, hospitals have no choice. Hospital and medical systems have to invest in that, because if their patient information keeps leaking out in the public, they're sort of dead in the water. On the other side of the fence of looking at just more general automation solutions, software improvements that can help, get into more medical records, I do think the adoption's picked up the pace there the past 5 to 7 years. We're certainly seeing that in a number of client engagements. But the wheels turn a little more slowly for the reasons I mentioned earlier, relative to, say, working in an average Fortune 500 company who is constantly focused on that bottom line and is constantly seeking ways to improve their productivity through automation solutions.
Let me ask a final question from my side to wrap up here. So you've got a lot of experience advising younger companies, mid-cap companies. What advice do you give companies when you first begin a discussion, whether you work with them or not, what advice do you give companies to help them ensure that they have a high probability of having a successful exit or capital raise? And maybe you can reflect on what are some of the mistakes that you see companies make in your career?
No, that's again, great question. I mean, I spend a lot of time, whether it be an early stage company or a mid stage company or even a fairly large firm, I spend a lot of time talking to owners about ways they can build value. It's always about how do you put in place a strong organizational chart and team? How do you fully develop your technology to really, and especially trying to drive towards maybe a kind of a recurring revenue type model? And how do you improve your performance? With the goal being that you want to have one day a company that is strong and financially strong, and you have a strong team so that when you either go sell or you go raise capital, that you're going to be in a position of strength and not a position of weakness as an owner. So I spend a lot of time talking to owners about and founders and companies that will have a 3 to 5 to 7 year look ahead. Don't just be looking right in front of you. You need to have every move that you make be a thoughtful move so that 3 years, 5 years, 7 years from now, you could say, gosh, I'm glad I did that back in 2017 because it really actually helped me create a more valuable firm in 2022. And so that's kind of at a high level my advice to owners, which is seek a lot of opinions, get a lot of advice, whether it be from someone like me or from a CFO or a good experienced board member who's built companies and sold them before. Have that 5 to 7 year look ahead.
Gotcha. And what about a company that says, hey, I'm looking to close a sale in 2018, and here's the company. It's got some warts. It's got some problems. What do you do in a situation where there's a fairly high level of urgency and you've got to kind of get a company in shape and looking pretty as quickly as you can?
Yeah, I mean, in those situations, I mean, we deal with those all the time, and that's fine. I mean, that's part of our job is the company calls us and says, kind of, here's where we are and here's who we are and the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that's okay. And that's certainly, no company's perfect. There's never, I've been in this business 15 years now and I have yet to meet a perfect company, and I never will. And I've met some really good companies, but we're in the, ultimately as an investment banker, we're in the story business. Our job is to learn a lot about our clients, to get the company, know the company almost as well as the owners know the company, so that we can first write about the story in our confidential marketing materials, and then ultimately talk to potential buyers or investors about the company as if we were the owner talking to them, especially on the front end of a process. You know, it's just ultimately if a company's got some, to use your term, warts on it, which most companies have some anyways, it's our job to just understand the story and be able to explain it. As we tell owners where you have issues, advise owners where you have issues, where you have problems, the main thing is you be able to explain that to the other party on the other side and explain, here's what we did, here's why it was a mistake, here's what we're going to do to rectify it, or here's what we can do to rectify it, and here's the roadmap to do that. Most seasoned strategic buyers and private equity groups, they're in the business of understanding that, and you know, that doesn't mean they won't come into play on valuation and negotiations, but with the right parties, which it's our job to bring the right parties to the table, you know, we usually can get over those hurdles.
Gotcha. Yeah, great advice. Thanks so much for taking the time and talking with us today. I really enjoyed it.
Well, this has been great. I appreciate it. And I love your podcast. And I look forward to continued dialogue with you.
Let me ask a final question. How can companies best reach out to you? And if a company does reach out to you, you know, maybe around advisory or something, what information do you appreciate that they share with you just to kind of have a nice warm introduction?
No, I appreciate the question. First, our website is bundygroup.com. That's B as in boy, U, N as in Nancy, D as in dog, Y, group, GROUP.com. My contact information, Clint Bundy's on there. It's just Clint at bundygroup.com. feel free, even if you just wanted to pick my brain, feel free to drop me a line. I have these conversations all the time. You know, when a company reaches out to us, usually we like to have an introductory call to learn a little bit more about the company and the situation. Usually I'll request financials pretty early on in some kind of discussion and dialogue, just to get a sense of the financial magnitude of the company and really to understand the goals of the company from the owner in terms of either a sale or a capital raise. So those are common topics in the early phases of conversation for us. And, you know, and then as we move on, we've got a lot of other questions and areas that we spend time talking with the owners about.
All right. Well, Clint, thanks again. I'll let you get on with your day. I really appreciate the time.
Hey, this has been great. Thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Industrial IoT Spotlight. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at IoT1HQ and to check out our database of case studies on IoT1.com. If you have unique insight or a project deployment story to share, we'd love to feature you on a future edition. Write us at eric.walenza@iot1.com.